Akkor tehát a következő előadom Erik Eineken professzor úr lesz, aki Löwenben doktorált orientalisztikából masterezett, 2013 óta bibliai és ókori más keleti nyelveknek a professzora a Regensburgi Egyetemen. Herr Professor Eineken aus Regensburg kommt nun, der in Löwen studiert hat und dann seit 2013 biblische Sprachen und alte orientalische Sprachen in Regensburg.
Yes, ja, ich werde mich auch mit Philo beschäftigen, aber es gibt doch, es wird nicht eine Verdoppelung sein. Erstens bin ich kein Philo-Spezialist, so das ist schon ein Unterschied. Zweitens bin ich mich auch mit den Abraham-Texten, aber nicht mit Agar-Sahai, mit den anderen Abraham-Texten. Und drittens, ich werde auf Englisch sprechen. So, das wird keine Verdoppelung. In 1963, the Swedish New Testament scholar Christer Stendahl published his article The Apostle Paul and the Introspective Conscience of the West, in which he demonstrated that the usual reading of Paul's theory of justification by faith is wrong. Paul's most important question was not about individual justification and salvation, but on what condition can Gentiles participate in God's commitment to and salvation of Israel. By their faith in Jesus Christ, the Gentiles participated fully in the salvation history of Israel and became part of the people of God without practicing the law of circumcision, the dietary laws, and the Sabbath. Ed Sanders, it was already remembered today, he also rejected the idea that in antique Judaism, the individual had to gain salvation through pious works of the law. And Sanders compared the religious structures in Paul's letter with that of contemporary Judaism. Religious structures offer Sanders the conditions that the religion itself gives to get in and stay in this religion. And he identifies these conditions as covenant nomism. To get in Judaism was only possible through the gracious choice of God. The Torah is not the door for getting in Judaism. It is only an instrument in order to sanction positively or negatively the covenant relation between God and his chosen people in order to stay in the religion. Judaism is therefore not a legalistic religion constituted on self-righteousness, but a religion based on God's grace and mercy. Those two innovations with regard to Pauline and early Jewish theology led to the so-called new perspective on post-justification theology. This developed into three directions. This is probably known to everybody. One by Sanders in further publications and Resenen, who developed the Christological ethnic perspective and the thesis of discontinuity with Judaism. The breaking point between Christians and non-Christians is the belief in Christ. This does not mean that for Paul the Torah is now deactivated. The Torah is given only to the Jewish people. If the works of the Torah would be essential for justifications, the Gentiles, as Gentiles, would be excluded. The second direction, nuancing this perspective, is the so-called sociological national perspective and continuity with Judaism by David Dunn and Nick Wright. For Dunn, the Torah functioned as an identity and boundary marker for the Jewish people that gave them a certain feeling of privilege. And according to Dunn, Paul's pronouncements on the Torah concern exactly this use of the Torah as a means of privileged and exclusive status of the Jewish people among the nations. So Dunn did not see a break with Judaism and Christianity. On the contrary, the critique of Paul on Jewish ethnocentric understanding of the covenant implies an expansion of the covenant to include the Gentiles, and this is according to the original intention of Torah, says done. The third direction by Gaston, who sees a dual covenant, I will not expand on this. So what I want to do now is to compare Paul's use of the Old Testament quotations and the portrayal of Abraham in Galatians with contemporary Jewish authors. But we have to remember that the new perspective has taught us that Paul was much more embedded in Judaism than was supposed before. Now, I start with Philo. I'm not going to go into Paul's use of those texts. It has been explained yesterday by Attila and also by Antje, so I can leave this out. The first quotation is in Galatians 3:6, quotation of Genesis 5:15-6. Paul uses this quotation as an answer to his own question in verse 5. Does God supply you with the Spirit and work and miracles among you by your doing the works of the law, or by you believing what you heard? In order to answer this question, Paul quotes Genesis 15:6. Now, what does Philo has to say on this particular verse? Philo comments on this verse several times. The context in the Bible is God's promise to Abraham of numerous progeny. For Philo, this has beside literal meaning also an allegorical meaning. Trust in God is much more valuable than trust in human goods, such as political power, honor, wealth, high birth, a good condition and health. All these are very unstable things. Therefore, he concludes, he who trusts in the former things has no trust in God, while he who distrusts them has put his trust in God. So Abraham is someone who believed in God, believed that is the queen of virtues, according to Philo. And in his own Abraham, Philo does not quote, in this particular text, he does not quote the rest of 16:5, Genesis 15:6, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness, because he there only wants to be certain that the only good thing that is infallible and secure is trust in God. And out of respect for Abraham's belief, God returns this belief, this business, with a trust, this is in return true and owed. And Philo refers here to Genesis 22:16, where God, after Abraham was willing to offer Isaac, reaffirmed the promise of a rich progeny. In Quis Rerum Divinarum, he also comments on 15:6, and there he quotes the whole verse, signifying that entire belief is the only in the only God is the most righteous thing to do. And from these quotations, we can conclude that for Philo, faith is has a very intellectual character. Faith is the result of a journey, is observing intellectually the ultimate being that rules and administers everything. Williamson puts this as follows: one begins to suspect that for Philo, business is the crown of intellectual achievement. Philo does not connect his belief of Abraham with obedience of the Torah, which is of course logical since the Torah was only given later. However, in Genesis 26:5, God repeats the oath of to Abraham, the oath of Genesis 22:16, and God motivates this oath because Abraham obeyed my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Philo is well aware that the law was only given to Moses, explained this as follows. Abraham, and I've put it also on the screen, was not instructed by writings, by striving, by virtue of unwritten nature, agraphas physis, to follow his healthy and uncontaminated impulses. One who kept the law, but as my account has made clear, himself is a law and an unwritten ordinance. So for Philo, natural law and the Torah are the same. The second text, Galatians 3:8,
which quotes Genesis 12:3. In Genesis 12, we have the story of Abraham, Abraham's migration from Chaldea to Haran, and then further to Canaan. On Abraham, Philo understands this allegorically as the soul's journey. Abraham departed from his belief in astral gods and created things instead of the creator who rules his creation. And the very significant are the omissions in Philo's paraphrase of God's promises of offspring and of the land. Philo does say that Abraham migrated from a foreign land to his own, as if Chaldea was a foreign country, while going to Canaan was returning home, implicating that leaving the false gods in Chaldea for the one God he encountered in Canaan was like homecoming. But the promise of the land inherited in his seed of Genesis 12:7 is not mentioned by Philo. In On the Virtues, Philo says of Abraham, "This man is a standard of nobles to all who come to settle in a foreign land, leaving that ignobleness which attaches to them from foreign laws and unbecoming customs, which give honors such as are due only to God." Now, it is clear from the context that Philo intends proselytes here, and he presents Abraham as a model that the proselytes can imitate, because Abraham was for Philo the first proselyte. In Virtue 260, he calls Abraham a standard of nobility for all proselytes. Nowhere does Philo discuss circumcision for proselytes, but since he declares in Migration 92 that although the laws including circumcision have also an allegorical meaning, they are not to be neglected, but are to be also observed literally, which implies, not explicitly said, but implies that it's also applicable for proselytes. Then the third quotation, or an allusion we have heard yesterday in Galatians 3:16, to your offspring and to your offspring, in the promise to Abraham, is mentioned several times in Genesis. However, Philo does not mention the offspring at all in his treatise, because consistent with his general approach to the five promises of land and multiple offsprings, Philo similarly leaves out God's address to Abraham in Genesis 13 and other quotations which features those promises. Very briefly on Josephus. The Jewish historian Josephus was more or less contemporary with Paul. He wrote in Rome with a special agenda. He created an apologetic historiography commending his nation primarily to non-Jewish Greek-speaking audience. And for that purpose, Josephus refrains from referring to claims of the Jewish people on the land of Palestine. So therefore, in the command of God to go to Canaan, in Antiquities, the promise of Abraham in Genesis 12:7 is left out. It does not refer to the promise of the land, nor to the great nations of Abraham, and important for us, also not to the blessing that will go forth from Abraham. And this is explained by Feldman, the specialist on Josephus. The absence of this promise is politically motivated. Josephus did not want the Romans after the first Jewish war to believe that the Jews wanted an independent homeland. The references important for Galatians 3 are omitted by Josephus for political reasons, for not disturbing his relations with the Romans. So it's obvious from this overview that Paul and Philo have the most in common. And the interpretation of Abraham in Josephus and other ancient Jewish literature is not so fruitful with regard to Galatians 3, although here we can of course observe clearly the tendency to idolize the patriarch. So Philo and Paul use Abraham quotations in their rhetorical strategy to convince the readers to make a specific choice. Philo wants to convince the non-Jews of the benefits of Judaism and presents Abraham as the first proselyte, who left polytheistic Haran to meet God in Canaan. So Abraham becomes a model to be copied. Paul uses another strategy. He attempts to dissociate the Galatians from the adversaries, and we have heard this morning, the Gegner, it has been discussed this morning, and to associate the Galatians with himself. And this implies polarization. He calls the adversaries those who confuse you, perverts, those who bewitched you, those who want to make a good showing, those who don't want to persecute for the cross of Christ, those who themselves don't obey the law. He curses them twice. He wishes them to be castrated. So the adversaries are the they, while Paul refers to himself and his associates as the we. And he qualifies them both with mutually exclusive attributes. Paul focuses on God, he's called by God, and the adversaries focus on human matters, because they want to show off. A second antithesis, between truth and hypocrisy. Paul defends the truth of the gospel, while the adversaries are led by hypocrisy and are inconsistent. The third antithesis, freedom and slavery. When the Galatians return to circumcision and the Jewish law, they become slaves again. That means they were slaves of idols, false gods before, and by accepting circumcision, they will become slaves of the law. Next antithesis, before and after the coming of Christ. With the coming of Christ, a new salvation economy began. Opting for the old economy of circumcision is contrary to God's salvific will. The coming of Christ brought the grace of God, but adversaries are not open to that. The last antithesis, the blessed and the justified, over of those who believe in Christ, over the cursed and unjust. And I've listed all those attributes here on the screen, so I don't have to read them again. So fundamentally, we have here a discussion, a debate about what determines Christian identity. And for Paul, Christians are called by Christ, just as he had been called, something to which he refers regularly. They are called to freedom in Christ, free from the false gods, free from the Torah. Christians are to believe in Christ like Abraham believed. Of course, the verse of the quotations of the Old Testament are important here. In 2:18, Paul says about himself and the other Jews, including Peter, that they came to believe, and we have come to believe in Christ Jesus so that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by doing the works of the law, because no one will be justified by the works of the law. This was a big step for him and for the Jews. For the Gentile readers of this letter, it must have been a bigger step, because they left polytheism with all the social relations and benefits. And Paul acknowledges this very well, and he tries to build an alternative identity for his group as brothers, or as he calls them, little children, for whom he is again in the pain of childbirth. And at the end of the letter, he uses the unique expression, the family of faith. For Paul, faith in Christ is what binds the we group together. And that is the fulfillment of promise that the nations will be blessed through Abraham. The promise to Abraham of an offspring is fulfilled in Christ, because the offspring, and Paul stresses it the singular, we have heard it several times, is Jesus Christ, a very remarkable interpretation of God's. So to conclude, both Philo and Paul are referring to Abraham for rhetorical reasons, but their aims are very different. For Philo, Abraham is a model, especially by proselytes, and Abraham's act of faith is a sign of virtue, something that can be copied by all who want to become Jewish. Paul tries to dissociate the Galatians from his adversaries, who most probably used Abraham and the fact that Abraham was circumcised as proof for their claim that the Galatians needed to follow Abraham's example. And Paul wants to associate them with his group, who were against his circumcision. Abraham therefore becomes a model of faith who believed and was justified before he was circumcised and before the Torah was revealed. This implied that the Torah became relative. If the reading of Abraham's text of Philo, as we saw, is representative for the Jewish interpretation in that time, it is very well understandable that Paul could not convince the adversaries by his argumentation and rhetoric. Philo was open to a symbolic interpretation of the Torah, but was not prepared to relativize it as something secondary to faith, like Paul did. So when we accept Sanders' characterization of Judaism as covenant nomism, we must conclude that the nomism of the covenant was so strong that it prevented the Jews from accepting Paul's salvation theology. Thank you very much.